Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Emma Southen, a historian and author, her most recent book being A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. This is episode CLV, Agrippina, Wife of Claudius. In many ways, Agrippina can be associated with the worst qualities of Livia, scheming, deceiving, and manipulating. But in her marriage to Claudius, you can see a different side of her, an ambitious, capable empress who made Claudius look good in his job. So is she any of these? Here's Emma Southen.
Agrippina the Younger is generally remembered as being notable because of her relationship to four emperors. She is the mother of Nero and is instrumental in his reign. She is the wife and also the biological niece of the Emperor Claudius, and is instrumental in making his reign successful. She's the sister of Caligula, less instrumental in his reign, but he thinks she's very important for a while. Then she is also the great niece of Tiberius and is briefly important in his reign. And because she spans that quite important part of early Roman imperial history, she gets remembered as a tyrannical, wicked woman who murdered her way to power.
That's a really good way to describe how she links so closely to a lot of members of that dynasty, because you only kind of think of her sometimes as Nero's mother and having a lot to do with that end of the dynasty, if you want to think about it that way. But she goes way back and you've got a lot of compressed time there.
Yeah, and she, you know, her first marriage is quite an important one. She's married to a cousin by Tiberius when she's a child because she is considered to be still a reasonably important part of the dynasty. Well, her mother is alive anyway, until, look, that goes pear-shaped. But she is still an important part of, like, Tiberius's family as well as Nero's.
Yeah. She's got currency as an important highborn girl, I suppose, and can be used to make a politically convenient marriage for alliance reasons. So where exactly in the family does she sit? So this is the daughter of Germanicus.
Yeah. So she's a daughter of Germanicus, who is descended from Octavia and Mark Antony. And she is the great-granddaughter of Augustus, so her mother. Agrippina the Elder is the daughter of Julia, who is the daughter of Augustus. Doesn't help that they all have the same name. So she is the great-granddaughter of Augustus. And because of a series of incidents and tragedies and scandals, by the time she's about 20, she is the last granddaughter left standing. Everybody else, all of Julia's other children, have been exiled or died. So by the time she starts having children, she is the last biological descendant of Augustus.
Yes. Her father dies when she was quite young. So Germanicus dies when she's around 4 years old.
Yeah.
But he was very loved in Rome and a military hero.
Yes.
So that's the kind of shadow that she grew up with as being the daughter of Germanicus, isn't it?
Yeah. As the daughter of Agrippina and Germanicus, she is like the daughter of the golden couple of Rome. Germanicus, he dies before he can mess anything up, really. He has a Titus energy to him. But he has some glorious victories in Germany. Particularly, he manages to get revenge for the terrible defeat in Teutoburg Forest, where they lost three legions. And he kind of finds their body and finally gives them a burial. He is also very handsome and charming and people love him. And Suetonius says that whenever he was in town, people would kind of chase him all around town. And if he was leaving Rome, they would follow him down the road for miles because they loved him so much. And Agrippina is descended from Augustus. So she has that kind of divine blood in her and that sense of being completely special in a way that nobody else is. So the two of them are just impossibly glamorous. Obviously, Germanicus dies when he's just in his 30s. He gets sent off to Syria and dies under what they consider to be suspicious circumstances. Agrippina's mother, Agrippina the Elder, believes that he's been murdered and insists on telling everybody that he's been murdered by Tiberius. So she grows up under this shadow of having a father who was the glory of Rome, would have definitely been the best emperor ever, would have been the one to save us from everything, but who was murdered by evil, wicked Tiberius.
And I guess growing up under the same umbrella is Caligula.
Yeah.
Which is a very strange umbrella, I guess, to be under.
Caligula is a weird one because it's like there's three boys and three girls, and two of the boys get swept up and are supposed to be Tiberius's heirs and are taken under Agrippina the Elder's kind of wing and are pushed forward constantly and are given these positions of power and are part of a political faction, and Tiberius is going to adopt them and they're going to be made Caesars and da 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 da. And poor old Caligula is just left at home, like nobody pays any attention to him. He doesn't get his toga of manhood until he's 19. I would have some abandonment issues. It saves him because obviously Agrippina the Elder and both of her eldest sons are exiled and executed by Tiberius for something treasonous that we're not entirely sure what it is. And Caligula's left at home because he's no threat to anybody. But I would have some issues if I were him. Of being
It seems like he may have.
Very much the favourite son.
So meanwhile, Agrippina and two sisters have some currency as elite women. So she's married at quite a young age. I've got here a 13th birthday she gets married.
Yeah, about then. So reasonably average for a princess. Her hand in marriage connects her to the throne. At the time that she's married, her brothers are probably in the line of succession. And marrying her is going to be marrying into the close imperial family. So she is definitely worth a fair amount. And so she gets a decent marriage. She marries a cousin. I always say with the Julio-Claudians, like, the best marriage you can have is a member of the family because everybody else is lesser and they've got a lot of members of the family. So, but her husband is about 30 when she gets married and everybody in the sources absolutely despises him.
Gnaeus?
Yeah, Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus.
Ahenobarbus.
He's very well connected. He is a cousin. He is up and coming. He's later a consul, but the only time Suetonius describes him is when he is describing him as the father of Nero. And so he is describing him through the lens of he's the father of the worst emperor we've ever known.
Okay.
And therefore he must also be, like, you can tell that he is a foreshadowing of what is to come. So he has all of these stories about Domitius, like, running people over, deliberately running over children with his cart for fun and taking out the eye of an equestrian in the forum because he insulted him, and just being like a whirlwind of psychopathy, basically. Yeah, and saying things like, oh, no child could ever be good who comes of me and Agrippina, which is the exact kind of thing that you would have somebody say if you were talking about Nero.
Yeah. So essentially trying to emphasize that Nero's worst traits had to have come from somewhere, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Suetonius is not particularly interested in women. Women don't appear very often unless they're doing something sexy with men. He's much more interested in fathers. So a lot of what we know about what Germanicus allegedly looked like, for example, comes from Suetonius's descriptions of how much better he was than Caligula, how he was so much more handsome.
So when Tiberius dies March 37 CE and Agrippina's brother Caligula becomes emperor, her status changes quite a lot, doesn't it? Because suddenly she's the sister of an emperor.
Yeah, and she is the sister of an emperor who is very keen on rehabilitating his family. Like, Caligula's early years, not that there's a lot of years, but very beginning of his reign is characterized by him rehabilitating his mother, who had been declared like an enemy of the state, and her birthday was an unlucky day, and she was supposed to be erased from the record. So he goes off and collects her ashes from the island she died on, and makes her birthday a day of celebration, and has her put in the mausoleum of Augustus, and mints all of these coins to say how great she is and how great Germanicus is. And he makes his sisters, as his only living relatives, a really important part of that setting up of a dynasty, of celebration of his family. So Agrippina and her two sisters become the first named living women on a coin, in a very famous coin of the three of them as deities with their names on them. So it's like Agrippina, Livia and Drusilla. It's really awkward because it's quite hard to get that on a coin, but...
I was about to say, that's a very crowded coin, but that's pretty cool.
It is. And there's Agrippina on the end and she's holding like this big cornucopia of like, obviously they're going to demonstrate that they're going to have loads of babies. Because Caligula can't really hold on to a wife and definitely doesn't have one. So he makes a really big deal of his sisters and he gives them all of these honours that had only really been given to Livia before. Even more than that, like he gives them all of the privileges of the Vestal Virgins and they become sacrosanct. You're not allowed to get in their way in the street and they get all the best seats at the theatre. And he just makes a really big deal of how important his sisters are to his reign. So when one dies and the other two betray him, it's quite a big deal.
Yeah, this is going to sound really flippant of me then. So where is Agrippina caught up, or is she caught up with all of the incest that's going on between Caligula and his sisters?
See, the incest, I think, is really interesting in the way that it's talked about, because it comes from Suetonius. In the way it's written in the Suetonius, it does not appear to be consensual. But it's always written about in modern sources as though they were having fun, sexy orgies. But the words that Suetonius uses do not suggest. It says that he took advantage of his sisters. You know, it's a slur on him that he's so horny that he is not only raping people's wives as they come to dinner, but he's also raping his sisters. And he just happens to love Drusilla the very best.
Yes. I've got Suetonius 24 open in front of me. So it says, the rest of his sisters he did not love with so great affection, nor honour so highly, but often prostituted them to his favourites.
Yes. Nobody ever mentions that bit, weirdly. Like, everybody's very interested in the incest, but not so much the bit where he would allegedly send out his sisters to go and be shagged by his friends. I think that the incest accusations are a trope, basically. It's such a thing that you throw at people in the late Republic and early Imperial periods. Either everybody is being incestuous with everybody, or it's just something you say about people who are too close to their family. And that he's very, very, very close to his sisters and very, very, very nice about them in public. And he's very upset when Drusilla dies. The Romans being the Romans like to make it sexy, basically, and be like, oh, he must have been shagging them.
It's interesting that they also, you know, cast judgment on that sort of thing, but they go, cousins marrying, fine, you know. And you can explain away Claudius marrying his niece. But
that's
when it comes to sibling kind of affection.
That's too far. That's too Eastern. Everything gets thrown at Caligula, like the litany of things that are said about him by Suetonius and Dio. He was definitely a bastard. But I do, like, I always feel almost bad for feeling sorry for him these days, but I do always feel a bit sorry for him. Like, he couldn't even be nice to his sisters without people being like, or be sad that his sister died without people suggesting that this was somehow nefarious.
You said earlier that this mightn't have been a mutual kind of relationship between him and Agrippina, at least. And I guess this kind of takes us to, I found it referred to as the plot of the three daggers.
Yeah.
I guess that's because there's three people involved, maybe.
And after it's all over, he dedicates three daggers to the Temple of Mars altar, like to show that he has defeated
that
this
would
great
explain
threat.
It.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is the plot of the three daggers and how does Agrippina take part in it?
The plot of the three daggers is a bit mysterious because we don't have Tacitus on it. This bit of Tacitus that covers Caligula's reign is missing, which is heartbreaking. So all we've got is Suetonius, who's unclear about everything, and an epitome of Dio, which is not very clear. What we do know is that Gaius was getting ready to go off to Germany to go and do some things over there, presumably to kind of emulate his dad. On the way, he stopped off at a holiday home where his sisters were. This is after Drusilla has died. And something comes out and he finds out that they have been plotting against him. There's some kind of big showdown at this holiday home. And he ends up having his sisters sent back to Rome for trial, along with his brother-in-law, so Drusilla's husband, who seems to be involved somehow, and a bunch of generals from the German armies. So there's two brothers who are running Lower and Upper Germany at the time, and they also get sent back and executed, and a couple of other politicians are included. So it seems like there was some kind of plot, which completely derails any of his German expeditions, mean that he has to have a big trial. And both of his sisters are sent off into exile. So Agrippina is sent to exile in a little island in the Adriatic. And his brother-in-law, who is also his best friend, like in all of the family portraits that he makes before this, like there's him, his three sisters and his brother-in-law, like just the one of his three brother-in-laws kind of plodded on the end because he likes him so much.
It's sad then.
I know. He has him executed and then forces Agrippina to carry his ashes to her island. So he is like completely betrayed by everybody. There's the very strong suggestion that Agrippina was banging her brother-in-law because he makes her carry the ashes. And they seem to have been this mention of like letters that have come out which declare that they were having adulteries. He declares the plot to be finished, has his three daggers, two sisters and the brother-in-law dedicated, and then has a bad time in Germany because now he doesn't have any generals and everybody thinks he's a dick. There's quite a lot of articles about this, like, oh, did it even really happen? Because the written sources hate Gaius so much that they suggest that he just made it up and randomly exiled and executed a bunch of people for fun. I am on the camp, I think, that there was something happening in its early stages and something dodgy occurring that he managed to walk in on and capture at its lower stages. It almost would have been better for him if it had gone a bit further and there was a bit more evidence that it had been happening. That ends up with him having nobody. He's now got no sisters at all, no family. He's out by himself. And poor old Agrippina is sent off into exile on a little island to twiddle her thumbs, potentially forever.
So she's got Nero with her at that point, doesn't she?
No, she's had Nero. Nero is two. Nero stays with his paternal aunt.
So he's in Rome.
Yeah, so he's left in Rome with Domitilla. There's two sisters called Domitilla because Romans don't name people properly. She's only in exile for a year because Caligula is murdered. During that time, her husband dies of dropsy, which is horrible. So she is exiled and widowed and separated from her son and left on an island for what she presumably thinks will be the rest of time.
But it isn't really that long.
It doesn't end up being that long. Mm. This is one of those moments in history where it could have really gone either way because Gaius is murdered and depending on who ends up with the throne depends on what happens to Agrippina, and when Claudius gets it, it depends on how he feels about people who are related to Caligula. Like if he could have decided to end the entire family, like they were such an important part of his reign, it would have been easy for him to just be like, you know what, end this and we'll start again.
But take care of that person on exile. Yeah,
exactly. But thankfully he sensibly decides that because Agrippina and Livilla are still are now the only two descendants of Augustus, and so they're the only two members of the Julian side of the family left, basically. So he brings them back to Rome, gives them kind of reasonable positions, like nothing particularly exciting. He doesn't want to build them up too much, but he gives them nice positions as nice members of the household. Probably would have been more sensible for him to execute them, but who am I to say?
Well, Claudius might agree with you at this point. So.
First thing they do when they get back, which I always find really funny, is Gaius has not been given a proper funeral and has been kind of just left buried in a garden. So the first thing the sisters do when they get back is dig him up and give him a massive funeral, like a proper marching through the night in Rome, statements on the rostra, big pyre.
Like, that's kind of nice. I like that a little bit.
It's such a bold move, though, given that he's just been stabbed in the street.
Could have gone either way.
Yeah, exactly. But it's such a, like, I don't know, it's such a two-finger move to everybody. Like, we are the Julian family and we do what we want. And we're not letting a descendant of Augustus rot in the street. We're going to give him the funeral that he deserves.
Because I'm keen to keep this on empresses, let's just fast forward a little bit and go, how did she end up getting married to Claudius? And I like how Tacitus essentially describes it as a political beauty contest a bit.
He does, and he has this super great scene. Claudius and his three freedmen sitting around a table having like a debate about who is going to be his next wife. And they all offer their own example, like their own favourite, one of whom is his previous wife, a woman who he has already divorced, which is quite fun. And then they offer up Agrippina because she's a member of the family. She totally deserves it. She's already got a son, so she's proved that she is capable of having children. And it would just be nice to have someone who is a member of the family around, basically.
See, I don't know if this is my translation just making this sound worse than it actually is, but it essentially says what you just did, but with worse terms.
Tacitus is...
she brought with her the grandson of Germanicus, who was fully deserving an imperial position, yes. Mm-hmm. Let the sovereign unite to himself a famous stock, okay?
Mm-hmm. That's famous stock, lovely.
Yeah, describing her in horse terms. I don't know if the Lerb's got any better with its translations, but in some ways, that'd almost be appropriate for Tacitus and how he thinks about these sort of people, I think.
Yeah,
so.
Particularly how he thinks about women. I always feel like Tacitus would really get on with Tertullian in the second century, who thought that women were the gateway for all evil and should be sad all the time for letting evil into the world. I really think they might have had slightly different philosophical outlooks, but I think that they probably could have had a nice chat about how much they hate ladies.
Agrippina is still in the vigour of youth and should not transfer the glory of the Caesars into another family. So she was recently widowed at 32 and much like her first husband, quite a bit younger than Claudius.
Yeah.
Is there a problem from the Roman perspective at the time of marrying someone who is essentially, well, she is his niece?
She is his niece. Claudius is her father's older brother. I know, it's super gross. There is a problem. It's very illegal. In order to get this through, Claudius has to change the law. Tacitus's version of this event is to minimize Claudius's involvement because his version of Claudius is just really passive and a bit useless and doesn't make any of his own decisions. He's either being told what to do by a Greek ex-slave or being told what to do by a woman. Both of which are equally bad in Tacitus's view. So he doesn't really make any of his own decisions. The other version of the story is that Claudius had just executed Messalina for marrying somebody else while Claudius was on holiday. Which is a story that baffles even Tacitus. He's just like, I've genuinely no idea how this could have happened. So he's had to execute her and he's now left bereft without a wife. So the other version of events is that Agrippina seduces him basically by using her familial access to sit on his lap and give him kisses on the cheek and let him look down her dress a little bit in an attempt to wiggle her way back into the line of succession. Both of them kind of downplay Claudius as an actor in his own life and career. And both of them give the power to somebody else. It's really a mystery how this comes about in real life. But the fact that she is Julian and there are no other Julian women left on that side of the family, and that she has Nero, who is really kind of in popular conception, has the right to be in the line of succession as the...
I see, yeah.
Means that she is an option and probably the best option. Any other option is going to be an inferior one to her. And also they are immensely popular. This is about 5 years after she's come back from exile. She's been married to somebody else who was a kind of friend and not a member of the family, and who was then made governor of Asia. So she spent some time in Turkey. So she spent most of her time outside of the city of Rome. But just before this, Claudius had held the Secular Games, which is the games celebrating the centenary of the foundation of Rome. and he had brought them out and had them paraded around Agrippina and Nero in front of the crowds, and they had received such a massive response of just pure outpouring of love that it kind of made everybody a bit anxious about them because people hadn't seen them really properly in a while, and this was one of their only public appearances, and Nero is about 11. Everybody is just so delighted to see the daughter of Germanicus, who they, you know, adore, and nobody really likes Claudius because he's not very, even in his best days, he's not exactly
photogenic.
He's not the most charismatic leader who hypes up the crowd and is more given to long digressions about the letters that he invented. So it kind of makes everybody a bit anxious about their potential power, and bringing that into the palace rather than having it outside of the palace is a fairly good political move. But what they have to do it is change the law. So they have the consul go in and kind of give this big speech while Claudius is not there. He's meandering around outside in a very nonchalant way, and give a big speech about how they want to gift Agrippina to him as his wife because he's so good and he deserves the best possible wife, and she's the best wife that he could possibly have, because, and again, get all those words, like, she's fecund and she's imperial and she's the daughter of Germanicus and she comes from good stock, and there's no better wife that our beloved Claudius could have, so we should give her to him as a present. And then
I'm cringing at the language of that, but
And then there's all this stuff about how they do it in Egypt and brothers and sisters marry in Egypt, and that's basically fine. And if we do it in other places, then surely we can do it here. And everybody agrees and says, yeah, okay, sure, fine. And then they rush outside to tell Claudius that they're going to give him a new wife, and he just happens to be standing outside. Like, I always have this image of him kind of walking around looking at a market stall, and they come up and he's like, my goodness, what a surprise to see you. But yeah, and they again declare that they're going to give him Agrippina as a wife. There's no record of how they told Agrippina that she was going to be given to her elderly uncle as a present.
So she's gone from the daughter of Germanicus to the sister of Caligula, and now the wife of Claudius we're at now. And it's terrible that I keep sectioning up her life in relation to her male relatives, but I guess that's where we're at for Roman imperial history.
Yeah.
So how does things change for her when she becomes the empress?
She is a real trailblazer. This is where we get to talk about her, which is good, because up until now, like, you have to see everything through the lens of the men that she is attached to, because nobody in the ancient world ever wrote about Agrippina. They wrote about her men, and when she impacted upon their lives, you got to see her. This is where you really get to see her, because she has a massive impact on Claudius's career. He almost immediately makes her an Augusta, making her the only person who is not an elderly woman to be an Augusta. The only two previous ones had been Livia, who is already old and a mother, and Antonia, who was three quarters of the way to death by the time, both of whom were quite intensely private. But Agrippina is not a private woman at all. And she is young and vigorous and an Augusta, which gives her a kind of first lady power, almost. Like, being made an Augusta puts her above everybody else. And she gets all of the day-to-day honours that come with that, like having lictors. So she gets like six lictors, which means that when she's walking in the street, there are six people walking in front of her, moving people out of the way. Like, it's now a parade when she goes out of the house rather than just her going out of the house. Because Claudius is quite weak and Agrippina is quite strong, she is able to sidle up by his side, basically, whereas there are no other imperial wives, particularly before this. There's Livia when Augustus is emperor, but Augustus is an incredibly strong in his pretending that he's not an emperor. His whole thing is not an emperor, just the princeps, just the first citizen, just so happens that you all really like me. And then Tiberius doesn't have a wife while he's emperor. Caligula does, but he has like three in a 4-year period, and none of them are given an Augusta status, and none of them are particularly important to his reign. So there's nothing there. And then there's Messalina. It's kind of a teenager and doesn't really know what she's doing. So she is kind of the first person who is trying to work out what it means to be an imperial wife as an Augusta and to be involved in day-to-day running of the empire rather than just sitting at home having more children. This really freaks out a lot of people. It freaks out Tacitus, who calls her masculine, because she doesn't dress up in shiny gold things and she's not interested in gardens and luxury and sex like women are supposed to be. She is interested in bureaucracy and administration and sitting in when imperial delegates come from other countries. And that freaks people out a lot. So you have when Caratacus, who is this British rebel, he causes all kinds of problems in Britain after Claudius invades. He's finally caught and brought to Rome. He's paraded through the streets as a kind of look, we finally caught him. And then at the end of that parade, he's kind of presented to Claudius and it causes a massive stir because Agrippina is sitting next to him. Instead of being off to the side or somewhere else or in a subordinate position, she is directly next to him. And Caratacus bows to Claudius and says, thank you for not murdering me yet. And then also bows to Agrippina. And this is a woman in a political position, basically. And this causes an enormous stir among people. It seems really shocking to them. Women don't do this. Women don't stand above men and command them or receive their honour in any way, even if that man is a British barbarian. And she's always in these positions. And then she kind of seems to kind of play with them quite a lot. So there's this bit with the draining of the Fucine Lake, which goes very badly. But she causes a stir by turning up in a Greek military cloak. So a very specifically male piece of clothing made of gold. Again, such a middle finger to everybody looking at her because she knows everyone's going to be looking at her anyway. So not only is it a military item of clothing, it is a Greek military item of clothing and it's made of gold thread. So it shines in the sun. Then there's a whole disaster because the lake doesn't drain as it's supposed to. So everybody just sits and watches a lake do nothing. there's all of these scenes and Tacitus particularly includes them because he finds them so shocking and horrendous of her being next to and by Claudius's side. Like she's not the great helpmeet behind him like Livia was. She's not doing the things that they think women maybe are supposed to do, like doing patronage and raising children so that they will be in the Senate and da da da. She is right there next to him in a big gold cloak, making men bow to her.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Agrippina, you know, just like being home, raising the children, or not even raising the children, but, you know, making her husband's clothes or anything like that.
Yeah.
It would have been hard for her to put herself forward in these sort of ways if she was married to any other emperor but Claudius.
And that's what you see when Nero becomes emperor. Like, one of the really striking things is how contingent the power that she manages to get is on the fact that Claudius lets her have it. Like, she has nothing official, no position of her own bar Augusta, which is just a name. They're still trying to work out what it means. It's only because Claudius never puts his foot down and says no, or pushes her away, or has somebody remove her from the situation, that she is able to be there, you know, making negotiations. And there are spaces where you can see her in the background putting her people in places. Like, she gets really involved in problems in Jerusalem and receiving delegates from Jerusalem, and ends up with loads of her friends being the governor of Jerusalem and resolving problems there, which all comes about because a Roman soldier during a Passover feast at the Second Temple amusingly farts on the Jews, which he presumably thinks is hilarious. And weirdly, the Jewish people of Jerusalem in the holiest of holies do not think is hilarious and cause a riot, which then causes a whole load of problems, which Agrippina has to sort out, which she does quite effectively.
Right, okay. I just don't know how they thought that would have gone down well.
Yeah, it's just one of those moments when you can really imagine like a Roman soldier going, this is going to be really funny, like an absolute dickhead with no education, and it is not funny at all. You can see her little fingerprints all over Claudius's reign, and it's because he lets her.
When you say little fingerprints as well, that extends to essentially pushing it not as far as Messalina does, and maybe a bit more tact involved than Messalina did with any of her actions. But we get told that, you know, she has a list of victims during the reign of Claudius, and she's having sexual favours as well with supporters and that kind of thing. Yeah. And a lot of that, you have to wonder how much of this is Tacitus.
Yes. So she has like these three big victims at the beginning of her reign, one of whom is supposedly like the most beautiful woman, set up as one of the rival wives, basically, and some people that she wants to kill just because she doesn't like them. But it is structured in such a specific way as to, so you get like all of Claudius's military stuff for about five paragraphs before, and then you get, meanwhile, Agrippina's killing people because she thinks they're too pretty. The sexual favours thing is specifically Pallas, who is one of Claudius's freedmen and who is her greatest advocate. And again, they are a man and a woman, they are close, and so people say that they are shagging, and specifically that she's only having sex with him because he wants to have sex with her for power, or they rely on each other in some way. I don't know, maybe they just fancied each other. She definitely wasn't shagging Claudius, so I feel like I can't hold it too much against her if she just happened to fancy him.
But she is most notably has the blame for Claudius's death.
Yeah.
Can I put it that way?
She does.
She's held responsible.
She's very much held responsible. If you ask anybody, they'll say that Claudius was poisoned with a mushroom and Agrippina did it. I go back and forth on this one quite a lot. So the story is, the Tacitus story is basically that in order to have Nero be the next emperor, which is Agrippina's main aim, Claudius has had to effectively disinherit his own biological son, Britannicus, who is a few years younger than Nero. So what they have done is, Claudius has two kids who are Octavia and Britannicus. He adopts Nero, which is when Nero is called Nero. He's called Lucius Ahenobarbus before that. He adopts Nero. He adopts out Octavia, has her adopted by another family so that he can then marry Nero to Octavia, because otherwise they would be siblings. And that's too far. Which makes Nero both his adopted son and also his son-in-law. And then he pushes Britannicus to the side. So Nero is given the toga of manhood and is given some kind of official positions. He's made like prefect of Rome at the age of 15, and he's made a judge, and he's given all of this stuff of marching around with the Praetorian Guard. He is given a lot of titles to kind of train him up in the Augustus mode. He follows exactly what Augustus did with Lucius and Gaius Caesar, to say, this is going to be my next heir. All of this was kind of fine when Nero was 13 and Britannicus was 8. But as time is going on, Britannicus is reaching a point where he's going to get a toga of manhood, and he's coming up to kind of 12, 13. And it's looking like Claudius might want maybe dual emperor, or he is starting to talk more about Britannicus. The Tacitus story goes that this freaks out Agrippina, who is concerned that Nero won't be the next emperor. So she decides that she has to enact her plans immediately and kill Claudius the Augustus. So she gets hold of a poisoner called Locusta. She mixes up a poison, puts it on a particularly delicious mushroom, and gets Claudius to eat it. The reason that she has to have a special poisoner is because Claudius eats and drinks so much that his metabolism is said to be too torpid to poison. So he would not be able to absorb the poison, which is broadly what happens. And then there's various different versions of what happens after he eats the mushroom as to whether it works immediately or it doesn't work, or she gets in a doctor who puts a poisoned feather down his throat to make him throw up, but actually poisons him again. But basically the story is that he is then poisoned. She shuts down the palace. She has Nero acclaimed as emperor by the Praetorian Guard before she tells anybody that Claudius is dead. And then the next day she comes out and says, Claudius is dead. Here's Nero. And it's a very neat story, and it is exactly the same as the story Tacitus tells about Livia poisoning Augustus.
There's figs in that, so, you know.
Yeah, but this exactly. But the story about Livia and Augustus is that Livia wants Tiberius to be the emperor. She has done all of this stuff to make sure that Tiberius is going to be the emperor. And now Augustus is talking about Agrippa Postumus, the remaining child of Julia and Agrippa, who has been exiled for having a beastly nature. All of a sudden, Augustus has started talking about him and how he should have a right to have some kind of line of succession. And he goes to visit Agrippa Postumus secretly. Livia finds out about this, panics, decides she has to enact her plan immediately, poisons a fig, gets him to eat the fig. He dies. She shuts down the palace. She has everybody agree that Tiberius is the emperor, and then comes out and says, Augustus is dead, Tiberius is the emperor, thank you very much. And it's just the exact same story, which makes it look really, really suspicious. Like, it's very obviously a narrative that Tacitus has that he really enjoys. The only reason, or the main reason, that I fall on the side of believing that she maybe did poison him is that there are no other versions of the story.
So Dio talks about this.
Yeah.
Tacitus and Suetonius.
Exactly.
All slightly different events happening, but the broad strokes are all giving you the same story.
So in my new book, which is about Roman murder, I have a whole bit about emperor murder. And every single emperor that dies, there is a story that they were murdered. Like every single one of them. Even the ones everybody loves. Unless they were died on a battlefield, there is a story that they were poisoned, that Marcus Aurelius poisoned Lucius Verus, and that Titus murdered Vespasian, and that then Domitius murdered, like, all of them. But this is the only one where there is no real version. It says that Claudius died of natural causes. There's only the poisoning story. The only thing is the pseudo-Seneca's Apocalypsyntosis, which is a super bizarre satire about Claudius going to heaven. Doesn't specifically say that he's poisoned, but every other version says that he was murdered.
It does give Agrippina a lot of agency, which I quite like about it. So she orchestrates it entirely, from the poisoning to the death to Nero being made the emperor.
Yeah. You know,
everything is her initiating it and pulling the strings.
Everything is her doing what needs to be done in order to maintain the line of succession and make sure that there is a smooth transfer of power to Nero. Yeah, so I go back and forth on whether she did or not. I don't mind the story that she did, to be honest. I feel like I would get fed up with Claudius and probably want to... I'm really mean about Claudius all the time. I know full well that it's because of my Claudius. I have a very strong theory that Claudius's reign was a disaster. He was murdering people left, right and centre. There were several rebellions against him by various generals around the empire, several attempts to kill him. Then he marries Agrippina and those just drop off. Like, there's no more rebellions. There's no more attempts in the Senate to rise up against him. The number of people that are executed for anything in the later years of his reign with Agrippina is like an eighth of the amount of people who are executed by him in the early years of his reign.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Partly because she is a strong and stable presence, and partly because she's really good at like making the reign look good and negotiating with people and making sure that people get what they want and not executing people. Something that she's accused of, for example, when we're talking about Britannicus, is that she had all of his partisans like fired and replaced the prefects of the Praetorian Guard so that they would be her partisans rather than his. But when you look at what happened to them and when it happened, one of the first things that happens after she marries him is Claudius replaces the Praetorian Guard prefects. But the two people that have been replaced are two people who, when there was a legitimate threat to Claudius's reign, when there was the crisis that Messalina had married someone else and was threatening to kind of run off with her children and make Gaius Silianus the emperor, the two Praetorian Guards ran and hid. Like, both of them vanished. Neither of them could be found for that entire day, which means that they are useless in a crisis of protecting the emperor. Like, they obviously cannot be trusted. If Claudius had been left to his own devices, I suspect he would have had them executed. But what she does instead is send them off to be centurions in different armies. So they're not executed. They get a kind of sideways shift, essentially. And then she replaces them with people who she knows are loyal to her, if nothing else. One of whom is Burrus. And this is spun by Tacitus as, oh, she's getting rid of people because they are partisans to Britannicus and she only wants her own people in. But also, at the same time, do you want people at the head of your personal army who hide when there's a crisis? Or do you want to shuffle them sideways so there's no family to be resentful? There's no big trial where everybody can then take a side in it. There's no scandal to talk about. What there just is a tiny little shuffle. Nobody can say too much about it, and everybody ends up quite happy.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you look at little things like that, you see that she's really smart at not upsetting the people around her and maintaining a system which is that she can trust and that doesn't upset people on the way.
That's historian and author Dr. Emma Southen, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. Applicable to this podcast, she's the author of the book Agrippina, Empress, Exile, Hustler, Whore, and her new book is A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. She is also the co-host of the history podcast History is Sexy, which I heartily recommend. As for this podcast, if you liked it, and if you got this far, I hope you do, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated, and hey, 'tis the season, would make a nice Christmas present. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Dr. Emma Southen on Twitter. Emma is at Nuclear Teeth, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we will continue the story of Agrippina as her role changes to the mother of the emperor. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.